38. 10:27 a.m., November 15, 2018, Chicago Police Department Homicide Division, Chicago, Illinois.
Is now good?
Kodo rapped on the open door to Chief Toby Whitcower's office. The chief was short and dense-boned, but despite outward appearances, the red cheeks, the straining eyes behind his thick glasses, he was not volcanic. Whitcower was a pragmatic man, a balanced man. He had a finely tuned eye for organization. The kind of person who walked into a dinner party and rearranged the books and straightened the foot rugs.
Come on in, detective. Shut the door.
Chief Whitcower sat behind his immaculate desk, glasses perched on his nose as he read through a rookie officer's report.
How is it possible, he said, for one person to get it's and it's confused in every single sentence.
Kodo sat across from Chief Whitcower.
Probably just didn't care enough.
Exactly what's wrong with the world today. No pride in people's work.
You said the feds are here?
Ready to rumble. Always ready, this one.
Chief Whitcower used to think Kojo's eagerness was due to being fresh, suffering from a bad case of rookieitis. He quickly realized that Detective Omabo wasn't trying to please anyone but himself. The eagerness was mistaken impatience. Kodo operated at another speed from the rest of the department. Hell, from the rest of humanity. Everyone else was playing catch-up. Kodo exemplified the sort of behavior that gets a homicide detective accommodation and a knife in the back. Chief Whitcower wasn't going to be the one to put it there. He figured he wouldn't likely remove it either.
It's the case from the university. The Walters girl and her mother.
Kojo was confused.
Mom's in on something?
Janice isn't Janice. She's Janet or Jill. Who the fuck knows who she really is? But her prints tell us she's been linked with some domestic terrorist incidents going back about 20 years. We're not talking anything with links to the Middle East or black nationalism groups. This is more cult-like, loony shit. Call themselves the Null Cohort. These cats don't leave calling cards or post manifestos. They're not out recruiting new members. From what I've been told, they target scientists, bureaucrats, and military doctors.
Null Cohorts? What the fuck's that mean?
I had no idea. So I use something called a dictionary. Amazing what you'll find inside an actual book. Null means nothing. But in scientific talk, it means having zero value or producing no signal. It is what the researchers are trying to disprove, or something. It gets complicated. Cohort is another fancy term, most of the time used in research. It means a group of people treated together, like at the same time in an experiment. Put them together and you get null cohort, a group of similar people who represent the opposite of what a research experiment would try to prove. But don't quote me on any of that. I barely understand it myself.
So these domestic terrorists are what? Rejects from a study?
Got me. Feds ran the connections. All the best data people at Quantico can't find a link between the targets. Could be that's the point. Could be it's just a major fuck you to the man. Thing is, that sort of agenda almost requires posting manifestos or uploading videos. These guys? Mum. Maybe their name is a joke. Or a distraction.
But we do know their name. That's something.
Maybe?
Kodo asked, what have they done? Chief Whitcower rubbed his eyes with his knuckles. He hadn't had any coffee in 3 hours. The single-serve coffee maker in the hall outside his office was shit. 1 minute it overfilled the mug with watery coffee, the next it was spitting and dripping sludge. Still, he'd take it. Hell is crowded with the ungrateful.
It all started in the late 1980s. Their modus operandi consists of mail bombs and shootings. Only 5 casualties. Some injuries, 1 doc was blinded, and a woman scientist lost a hand. Not exactly top-tier stuff. But considering how long it's been going on, the feds sniff out any and all associations. And Ashanique Waters' mom is part of this.
That's what I've been told.
We've been asked to gather up everything we have on her, going back at least 10 years under 5 different aliases.
It ain't much, tell the truth.
Outstanding warrants for trespassing, breaking and entering, and shoplifting. But whoever Janice is, she's excellent at getting out of trouble, and fast.
Kojo nodded. He seemed to be getting it.
Of course, Whitcower thought. If anyone got it, it'd be him.
How about the girl? Anything on her?
Chief Whitcower thumbed through a neat stack of papers on his left, pulled out one, and skimmed it over briefly, before turning back to Kojo.
You probably already know more than me. She's in middle school. Gets decent grades, but nothing spectacular. Misses a lot of class due to some sort of illness. A lot of notes from the school nurse about pain here and there. A lot of calls from the mom, letting the school know she's out sick.
So you're going to show me what you've got on Janice?
Time's tight. You can take the stack here, but...
Chief Whitcower opened a desk drawer and pulled out a video cassette and file folder. He handed both to Kojo.
There's a TV with a built-in tape player in the back office. In the folder, you're going to find a note from Dr. Shapiro, the police shrink who interviewed her. Half the shit he says isn't important, but you'll want to read it anyway.
Kojo located the TV VCR in a storage room near the showers. It hadn't been touched in at least 10 years. He grabbed a towel from the locker room to wipe the thick film of dust from the screen. Kojo plugged the TV in and dragged over a stool with a warped leg. Before he popped in the video cassette, he opened the folder to read Dr. Shapiro's notes. The ducks overhead came on, and cobwebs, blown free by the ensuing breeze, drifted lazily onto the pages. 39. 6/17/2005. Note from Dr. M. Shapiro.
I wanted to include a personal note with this file. I'll admit at the onset that I might have let this case get to me a little. Excuse the informality, this is primarily for my own benefit, as Mrs. Olander's case is complicated. Much of this is summary of the interview tapes, but it provides an excellent background on Mrs. Olander's paranoid delusions, perhaps enough material for a case study or white paper. Mrs. Janet Olander, a suspected pseudonym, was apprehended during a sweep of a suspected drug manufacturing lab in Pullman. The owner of the lab, Mr. Datlow, is also suspected of being involved with an obscure anarchist group called, variously, Null or Null Cohort, though both, of course, deny any and all involvement. While Mrs. Olander was caught in the sweep alongside 2 other women, Mr. Datlow was not. As of the time of this note, all 4 are suspected of having fled the state. The files have been turned over to the FBI. Those are the facts. What I found most fascinating about Mrs. Olander's case was everything else. She talked of conspiracies inside conspiracies, really detailed stuff that, honestly, I had not encountered outside of some of the major literature. Dagnall, Parker, Vanderlinden. So I jumped at the chance to go deep on it. If anything, it makes for some stirring reading. Note, it should be mentioned that Mrs. Olander only volunteered this information because she thought I might be able to help her. And she claimed to be suffering from a medical ailment that was impairing her judgment. More to come. She was hesitant at first and suggested there would be deadly repercussions, but eventually relented. She was evaluated for intoxication. Labs were run but proved negative for any recreational prescription drugs that might have affected her. Oddly, we did detect the presence of a cancer treatment medication new to the market, but it was found in only faint traces. Here are the bare bones as far as I can work them out. Janet claimed to be tangentially involved with a group called Null or Null Cohort. She was evasive about the mission of this group and her involvement. From what I can glean, interviews and FBI insiders, this group, classified as anarchists, has been targeting scientists, military officers, and psychologists with mail bombs. As far as I can determine, and I'm not alone, there is no correlation between those people targeted. No common place of work as listed, and no common interests. There were 7 victims of Null over the past 20-odd years. They are below with notes when available. All of the victims suffered burns and or lost a hand, fingers, or eyes, eyesight. There were 2 fatalities. Dr. Owen Went, Tallahassee, Florida, 1987. Retired primatologist, formerly at Fort Detrick. Admiral Frederick Cook, Silver Springs, Maryland, 1989. Retired chief of naval research, stationed in the Western Pacific. Dr. Joseph Kerwin, Joplin, Missouri, 1989, fatally injured. Former Duke professor, author of the Lubin Papers, a 60s-era study into altering consciousness via light deprivation. Dr. Lisa Kuby, Seattle, Washington, 1991, research scientist associated with Dr. Kerwin. Dr. Carolyn Barnes Spear, Taos, New Mexico, 1994. Physician at Taos Addiction Control Center, Stanley Bennett, Washington, D.C., 1998. Fatally injured. Retired engineer, developed medical imaging technology. Sergeant Julian Marchetti, Dallas, Texas, 2000. Former associate of deceased bacteriologist Frank Olson. Though there is no documentation to support Janice's accusations, she claims all these people were involved in a covert CIA mind control program, similar in nature to the infamous MKUltra. In fact, Janet claims that this project, she would not give its name, was an offspring of Ultra itself. So, in her mind, the Null are getting payback, punishing scientists and military personnel involved in a clandestine experiment, one that I can find no evidence of. Here is where things get interesting. According to Janet, the purpose of this experiment was to take the lessons learned in the magic room and apply them in a new, more technologically advanced setting. What is the magic room? Good question. It took me several weeks to track the information down. Below is an excerpt from a letter I received from Dr. Franklin Gross, a history professor at Wash U. A good summary. What you have to know is that our world came within seconds of Armageddon in the 1950s. A nuclear holocaust seemed inevitable. The only thing keeping it at bay was knowledge. If we knew what our enemy knew, then we could be one step ahead of them. We could get our finger on the launch key before they did. But of course, the knowledge we needed was inside the heads of people who didn't want to divulge it. We had to make them talk. We had to bring them over to our side. It was the same on the other side, too. We toyed with truth serums, LSD, electroconvulsive therapy. None of it worked as efficiently as we'd liked. Some scientists, particularly in Eastern Bloc countries, explored the outer limits of pain as a means to gain mental control. That was effective up to a point, but the results were short-lived. But in 1954, we learned of a new technique, the magic room. It was the new invention of some very enterprising psychiatrist in Hungary in particular, a Dr. Laszlo Nemeth. The room itself was in a prison. It was unusual in every facet of its design, 12 feet by 15 feet in dimensions. However, it was not rectangular, but oval-shaped. The walls curved outward. There was a bed, easy chairs, a desk, a toilet, and sink. All told, the magic room looked quite comfortable for any political prisoner who was used to being shoved into a room the size of a sardine can with 10 other inmates. But That deception was core to the purpose of the room. The bed was sloped. It touched the ground at the end. Nearly impossible to sleep in. All the furniture was likewise uncomfortable. Built at odd angles or with exceptionally rough materials. And all of it was covered in a highly reflective material. This is because of the lights. All the lights in the magic room had rotating lampshades. They were painted in bizarre, clashing colors. And as the lampshades turned, they produced bizarre, you could say, psychedelic patterns on the walls. Well, on every surface of the room. It was like being in an ever-shifting, red-hued, underwater grotto. Enough to drive anyone to madness within a few days. But Dr. Nemeth wasn't after madness. He was after truth. He wanted to control his patients' minds. To do that, he used the silver beam. What was the silver beam? Possibly just a bright light, but it might also have been something more. That something more, according to Janet, is a linear particle accelerator. Yeah, there are many of these in use. You can look up the basic physics of how they operate, but they essentially generate X-rays and high-energy particles for research and medical treatment. This covert research program used a linear particle accelerator, or LINAC, as they are known, to brainwash experimental subjects. That's what they tried. I should mention briefly who they are. The head, or Human Ecology Division. As near as I can tell, the head is a study group associated with several universities and medical schools that focuses on cross-cultural research and is interested in the relationship between man and his environment and the neurological dimensions of adaptive processes, whatever that means. Janet claimed the head was really a CIA-funded group running brainwashing. She called it thought reform, experiments on unwilling participants, mostly orphans. That part gets me too. According to Janet, most of the study's subjects were taken from orphanages, though some were actually lifted right off the street. The dates of these experiments are a bit tricky. She talks on the tapes of 1970s set experiments, but claims it began decades earlier. Regardless, the children were transported to a remote facility where they were tortured, abused, and experimented on using LINAC machines. The purpose of all this awfulness, to break their wills, erase their minds, and then plant new memories. Janet was one of these orphans, only she wasn't really. She was the daughter of the lead experimenter, a particle physicist named Dr. Celeste Thiriot. I can find no record of a scientist by that name. Apparently, Dr. Thiriot believed that the then burgeoning technology of particle accelerators offered deep insight into how memories were formed and stored in human DNA, the Morris hypothesis. She aimed to prove it was true and wanted to use it for the aforementioned mind control programs they were developing. While they successfully used the accelerators to erase memories, rewriting them with new ones became problematic. The scientists couldn't get the process to work, though Dr. Thiriot labored tirelessly to crack the complicated mathematics. She committed suicide sometime in 1979. Leaving Janet with the head. It is unclear exactly what happened next. Janet was experimented on with the rest of the remaining orphans at this clandestine facility. How Janet got out is also unclear, but she has been on the run ever since. Apparently, there is something of an underground network, shuttling various survivors around from city to city to hide them. Janet claims a good number of these people are in the network, but there are some who are outside of it, completely hidden, off the grid, so to speak. Further, she claims that the head is still active, not only pursuing her, but also continuing to run secret, dangerous experiments without government oversight. She supposes that their techniques have advanced significantly over the ensuing years, and that they have potentially gone even further underground. Last but most important, Janet claims it was a curious side effect in a small subset of the subjects, dubbed the Null by the researchers. These Null subjects were able to access latent memories of past lives that were encoded in their DNA. Some of the Null could remember back generations through hundreds, sometimes thousands of years, maybe even millions. The Null cohort, note that it's the same name as the anarchist group, have been damaged to the point that they require ongoing medication, the aforementioned cancer drug, to avoid losing their minds. Why isn't exactly explained, but I suspect it has something to do with the past life memories that are invading the brains of Null members. This, Janet explained, is why she was acting as though she were high. She was, in fact, overwhelmed by her past life memories. I could go on. I haven't mentioned the business about the creation of AIDS using particle accelerators. Apparently, one was also used to cover up the murder of a promising young scientist in the mid-1960s. Or the equally outlandish claim that the head employs people known as night doctors to capture their unwitting subjects. These night doctors, apparently, are something of a historical boogeyman, largely afflicting African-American communities. You can see why I got so wrapped up in this thing. It writes itself. Martin Shapiro, Doctor of Psychology. 40. Kojo placed the pages on his lap and stared at the videotape in his hand. Clearly, Ashanik's mother had paranoid delusions, and clearly, those delusions had found their way into her daughter's mind. It also made the madness of feeding her kid experimental cancer meds more palatable. The woman was insane. She'd been insane for years. Somehow, she'd hit it really well. Kojo considered stopping there. Do you really need this videotape? What more is there to know? Call it a detective's instincts or call it morbid curiosity. But Kojo needed to see Janet say these things. He needed to hear it for himself. Kojo pushed the videotape into the ancient TV VCR. Then he pressed play. A black screen filled with burned-in white text, identifying date, location, names, and tape details appeared first. Then, the image cut to a blurry shot of Janet, looking haggard and thin, sitting at a police table, a blank wall behind her. Dr. Shapiro off-screen spoke first. Name, Janet Olander. Address unknown. Age, date of birth. 36, unknown. Place and state of interview. Station 302, June 12, 2005. Time, commenced 13:23. Concluded 14:51. Tape reference numbers 11, 21, 31, and 41. Interviewing officer, Detective Chief Superintendent, 2812 Rogers. Dr. Shapiro, lead. Declaration. This transcription of the video recording consists of 5 pages, is the exhibit referred to in statement made and signed by me. Signature of physician. Signature of officer preparing record. Tape 1. 1:15. Dr. M. Shapiro. This interview is being videotaped and audio recorded, and is being conducted in an office at the Chicago Police Station. I am Dr. Martin Shapiro of the Chicago Police 12th District. The woman across from me is Mrs. Janet Olander. Would you please pronounce and spell your last name for me? J. Olander. O-L-A-N-N-D. Dr. M. Shapiro. Are you having difficulty focusing, Mrs. Olander? Would you like a glass of water?
Jay Olander.
I'm fine.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Are you sure?
Jay Olander.
That I'm fine?
No.
I need those pills. The yellow and white ones you took off me, they help.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
You're talking about the cancer medications. The Metrochime.
Jay Olander.
Yes.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
I'm afraid I can't do that. Those medications were stolen and, as far as we can ascertain, you do not currently have or are in remission from cancer. Can you explain to me why you think you need the medication?
Jay Olander.
Look at me. Listen to me. I'm struggling.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Have you taken any other drugs tonight? Either over-the-counter or illicit, or both? Anything we should know about that might help us make sense of what you told the officers who picked you up earlier this evening?
Jay Olander.
My urine is clean, you already know that. Listen, I'm sick, okay? That's all. I was a police officer once, you know? I get how this works. This whole thing is supposed to go. You need to get me those pills.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
You were an officer. Where?
Jay Olander.
San Francisco. A long time ago.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Mrs. Olander. I can't give you those pills. But you're here now to tell me about tonight's incident. Can you tell me exactly what you were doing at the residence of one Mr. Datlow, 400 South Corliss Avenue?
Jay Olander.
I was visiting.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
This address is a suspected drug lab. Do you know what was being made there?
Jay Olander.
I know you don't want to go down this rabbit hole, Dr. Shapiro. You'll regret it.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Why is that?
Jay Olander.
They'll come for me. It isn't safe here.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Who will come?
Jay Olander.
Don't do this, Doc. I don't feel well.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
In addition to the chemical compounds and equipment associated with the suspected manufacture of drugs, there are also many weapons and bomb manufacturing materials discovered in Mr. Tyler's residence. When you were visiting, were you aware of these items?
Jay Olander.
I don't think you're listening to me, Doc.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
I believe I am. I think you're just not willing to answer my questions. I'm not here to assess your innocence or guilt. I'm here to assess your mental status. You told the arresting officers some very concerning things. Can we talk about them now?
Jay Olander.
You think I'm a terrorist.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
I don't make any assumptions about you. I am here working for the Chicago Police Department to evaluate your mental status at the time of your arrest. You told the arresting officers that you were part of an experiment. Is that right? That you had escaped?
Jay Olander.
I wasn't myself then.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Were you on drugs at the time?
Jay Olander.
Sure.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Okay, let's start over. Can you tell me anything about the place you escaped from? The experiment.
Jay Olander.
It was a lab. In a remote location. Way off the grid. Military at the time. The people who ran it, they were doctors with a group called The Head.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
Head?
Jay Olander.
It stands for the Human Ecology Division.
Dr. M. Shapiro.
And what exactly do they do?
Jay Olander.
You ever hear of MK Delta or MK Ultra? The brainwashing experiments they did? How about the Lupin papers? Or Dr. Joe Kerwin at Duke University? He ran parapsychology labs that did covert research on something Curran called the Fold.
And those were just the programs that came to light. They were dinosaurs, the agency stumbling in the dark to try and tap into here. J.O. points at her left temple. Dr. M. Shapiro. Agency as in the CIA. J. Ollander. Yes. Dr. M. Shapiro. You're suggesting it was a mind control program. Something like brainwashing. J. Ollander. I'm not suggesting, Doc. Dr. M. Shapiro. And you were part of this program. J. Ollander. Not at first, I wasn't. My mother was, but... Long pause as she closes her eyes and leans back. Here's the rub, Doc. My mom. She was in charge. The whole thing was her idea. I was just along for the ride. Dr. M. Shapiro. This program, what was it designed to do? J. Ollander. Terrible. Terrible things. To children. Dr. M. Shapiro. Like what, Janet? J.O. holds her head and mumbles indistinctly. J. Ollander. Genetics. They had an accelerator. Mom did the math, you see. It's all about memory. Dr. M. Shapiro. Like memorization. J. Ollander. No. Like targeting GLUR. Proteins, before they form, they call it clarity. Dr. M. Shapiro. Tell me what that means, Janet. J.O. slowly sits upright, with her face forward. Her eyes are locked on Dr. Shapiro's eyes. She appears lucid. She leans in with her eyes still on his. J. Ollander. Do you know what it's like to hunt an antelope with spears in the Carpathian Mountains? To slaughter Spanish soldiers in the surf of Melilla? Dr. M. Shapiro. No, I do not. Janet, you said you're on the run. Can you tell me why they are chasing you? J. Ollander. We're the ones who got away. They hunt us because if the world finds out we exist, it will destroy everything they've been working toward. And... J. O. leans forward. I know a secret. The key to a code they want to crack so, so bad. A few years ago, if they'd got it, it would have worked. But the technology hadn't caught up. Now that it has, my mind's too fragmented to remember it all. Ironic, right?
11:45. End tape 1. 41. 10:43 a.m., November 15, 2018, University of Chicago Center for Integrative Neuroscience, Chicago, Illinois. Ashanique sat still as Tomiko placed an ECG cap on her head. They were in her lab on the fifth floor, and the ECG cap resembled a shower cap, skin tight, with dozens of electrodes protruding from the surface. The electrodes were connected to thin white wires. They, in turn, led to the machines that read the electrical activity in the brain. Tomiko seemed satisfied. Sitting on a rolling chair nearby, Matilda gave Ashanique a thumbs up. She swung a bar across the front of the rather ominous chair Ashanique had been placed in. It had a plastic chin rest and a rubber-coated forehead brace. Slowly, gently, Tomiko moved Ashanique's head into position, her chin on the rest, and her forehead pressed up against the brace.
Are you comfortable?
Ashanique said.
Not exactly. But enough? Yeah, enough. How long does this test take? Only a few minutes. You shouldn't feel anything.
Tomiko rolled a monitor on a cart up in front of Ashanique. She adjusted the height of the cart so Ashanique could look directly at the monitor without moving her head. Tomiko explained that the monitor would display a series of images and words. She wanted Ashanique to read them to herself. The ECG would register the electrical swells and dips associated with each image or word.
This will show us exactly what parts of the hippocampus are most active.
We'll be able to target those specific neurons associated with long-term memory. The images will guide the process. Bet just to ease into it, okay?
Okay,
Ashanik said. Matilda gently rubbed the girl's shoulder.
You'll do great, she said. There are no wrong answers here.
The lights were dimmed, and Ashanik felt like a guinea pig. Her face pressed up against the plastic guard, her head immobile under the weight of the ECG wires. She stared at the monitor as it suddenly flickered to life. At first, she thought it would be like watching TV. Maybe she'd be shown one of the Disney channels she remembered from third grade. Ashanik imagined it wouldn't be so bad if she was just shown a funny TV show, and the computers tracked the electrical output of her brain while she was laughing inside. But Ashanik knew that wouldn't happen. Out of the very corner of her eye, she saw Matilda sitting with her arms crossed and looking worried. The same look Ashanik's teachers had when her mom would come to school for parent-teacher conferences. The teachers were always the ones on the defensive. Janice showed up armed with every assignment Ashanik had completed and an excuse for every day she missed or was late. Ashanik understood why when the first image popped up on the monitor.
What is this?
Ashanik asked loudly. Tomiko said,
just watch the images. React inside your head. Don't speak.
The first image on the screen was a short looped video of soldiers running over a barricade made of loose stone and dirt. The footage was grainy and jumped, speckled with age. Ashanik recognized this war. She'd seen it in vivid, crystal clear color. Her pulse quickened, and she heard her heart in her ears. And just like that, it ended. 10 seconds later, a series of photos flashed across the screen. They were Polaroids of handwritten calculations, numbers scrawled on a sheet of paper. Ashanik didn't know what they were, but her body did. She felt every muscle tighten and started to grind her teeth. Whatever this test was meant to do, Ashanik didn't want to participate any longer.
Is this almost over?
Ashanik asked Tomiko. Tomiko seemed irritated.
Please just finish the test.
Maybe there's another test we can run?
Matilda jumped in. Something a little less invasive?
This is hardly invasive, Tomiko said.
Glancing away from the screen, Ashanik could see Tomiko staring at the ECG readouts as she thumbed through them. Her expression was incredulous.
Keep going, Tomiko said. It'll be over soon.
On the monitor, more video footage rolled. It was a shot from the hood of a car as it drove along a rutted, narrow road through a snowy forest. Ashanik knew this was the same place she'd drawn, the place she'd seen in her memories. But instead of watching the footage, Ashanik was desperate to close her eyes. She felt sick to her stomach. She felt like she was going to pass out.
My head hurts,
Ashanik said, breathing hard.
I have to stop. You can't stop now.
Matilda lurched from her chair.
Tomiko, stop this. My head,
Ashanik moaned. On the monitor, the video footage of the car in the forest sped up. Double time, then triple. The forest flashed by, a smear of green and white. Ashanik couldn't tell if it was getting faster and faster on purpose, or if it was just her mind losing its focus. The monitor was so close to her face, she felt as though she were about to fall into it. She could practically smell the pine aroma of the forest. She could actually hear the car's tires grinding on the road. Ashanik slumped forward, her limbs too heavy to move.
Please, stop this. You have to push harder. We need to see this through,
Tomiko said. Matilda had seen enough. She stood and moved to pull a limp Ashanik away from the monitor, but Tomiko beat her to the punch, sticking a taser into Matilda's right side, just below her breast. 8 million volts of electricity forced her body rigid. Matilda fell to the ground, unconscious. Tomiko ignored her and pushed Ashanik closer to the monitor.
You are unique, Tomiko said. You're the only child of a null we are aware of.
In the lab, we saw the clarity develop only after 2 weeks, sometimes months of heavy testing, heavy exposure. But you, Ashanik, you're not like the others. They had to be awakened by forceful prodding. Not you. You awoke on your own.
Wide eyes glued to the flashing screen. Ashanik's eyes rolled to white. She sank into herself and saw the life just before her own.
42. 11:38 a.m., May 30, 1975. Three Saints Bay, Kodiak Island, Alaska. Winter is just loosening its grip on the mountains. Parts of the earth tumble. Rocks and low-slung shrubs toward a slate-gray bay. Fog rolls in ropey coils across the water, shrouding the remnants of an old gold rush town. It was a desolate land then. It is even more desolate now. The roar of an engine breaks the heavy silence as a camouflage Humvee tears down a twisting, narrow dirt road at the water's edge. Mud spattered and worn, the vehicle is tattooed with military insignias and an American flag. Inside the Humvee, a long-limbed but reed-thin African-American girl sits between the two soldiers. The one behind the wheel has a mustache and red cheeks. His name is Morton. By the window is Phillips, a tall black man with steely eyes and a habit of rolling his cigarette lighter between his fingers in a fluid hypnotic arc.
"We're going to see my mom, right?"
Janelle Walters asks the soldiers. She is 6 years old. Morton and Phillips are silent. They've been silent most of the drive from the airport. Phillips said a few words to Janelle when they stopped for a snack in a small town with only one gas station. She had to pee something fierce, and he walked her to the restroom and told her to make sure to lock the door behind her. When she was done, she unlocked the door and peeked outside and saw Phillips standing there, still as a statue, with his hand on the gun on his hip. After they'd climbed back in the Humvee, Morton handed Janelle a bag of chips and a tab cola. He told her to make sure not to make a mess, the only words out of his mouth the whole time. Then he looked at Phillips, and Phillips shook his head.
"Man, least we outside and stretching our legs."
Janelle knew they were talking about babysitting her. When they met her at the airport, Morton had been in a funk. Janelle figured out quickly it was because he hated being around kids. The idea that he had to pick up this brat from the airport and drive her across the island made him surly. Phillips tried to calm him down, but no matter what he said, Morton just shrugged it off. Janelle thought Morton was an angry person, and she didn't like the idea of sitting beside him. What would he do if she talked too much or asked too many questions? Janelle's mom said she had a mouth on her. It took everything Janelle had to keep quiet for that first hour. But then she had to pee. Finally, they're getting close. Janelle can sense it in the men. The whole way up until now, Morton was driving with both his hands on the steering wheel, gripping it like he was trying to strangle the life out of it. Now he's leaning back and his hands are loose. Phillips is doing that thing with the lighter. Janelle's fascinated by it.
"It's been 2 weeks since I saw her last," Janelle says.
Philip says,
"She'll be glad to see you, I bet." "Kind of cruel," Morton says.
Judging by his tone, Janelle can already tell he's about to say something mean, something that will likely upset her. But she's close to seeing her mom now. No matter what Morton says, she's determined not to let it dampen her mood. Not one bit.
Phillips says, "Don't start this. The girl."
Morton gives Phillips an ugly sidelong look.
"That's my point exactly. It's like bringing your lapdog to the pound to visit all the other poor fuckers. Rubbing it in their faces, you know? Boss wants to see your kid, and watch your mouth."
Morton scoffs. Janelle has heard worse.
"All I'm saying,"
Morton continues his tirade,
"seems kind of sick,
Makes me wonder what the real reason is. Maybe she just wants to see her kid. Maybe she's got something else in mind. I don't care what they tell me. How they talk all big and fancy about revolutionizing warfare. What they're doing in that base is just a few steps above what we saw Gooks doing. Some of that shit... You're gonna scare her, Philip says.
Janelle says, You can't scare me. I know it's all just talk.
Morton laughs. It's a hollow sound like a rock tossed into a well. The Humvee screams around a corner. A half a mile ahead is a checkpoint with a rolling fence. It is topped with razor wire, like Janelle seen in the movies about prison escapes. All she can think is that her mother is safe behind those fences. Out here in the middle of nowhere, it makes sense to have the maximum protection. Who knows what runs up and down these mountains in the darkest part of night? Janelle certainly doesn't want to know. At the gate, Morton flashes his badge at a waiting soldier.
We got Dr. Tyrael's kid here.
The rolling fence opens, and the Humvee roars through. Janelle doesn't speak for the rest of the ride. Her eyes are glued on the road. Her whole body is alive with expectant electricity. The dirt road twists for another 5 miles inland before the base materializes from the surrounding evergreen forest. It is black and squat, and parts of it are covered in camouflaged tarps. Janelle knows that if they'd approach the building from any other angle, it'd evaporate into the trees. How cool. Not only did Mom get to work at a lab tucked into the mountains, but it was a secret lab. The Humvee stops in a rock-strewn lot a few yards from what Janelle assumes is the front door to the place. Morton gets out first and stretches. Before he opens his door, Phillips turns to Janelle.
Your mom's missed you, he says. Been talking about seeing you for a long time. Can't get her to shut up about it, to be honest.
Really?
Janelle asks, the surprise in her voice obvious. Philip smiles and nods. He's never spoken to Dr. Tyrael in his life. She doesn't pay any of the military staff any mind. He's never seen her in the commissary, and she doesn't ride the elevators like the other scientists. When she's passed him in the halls, she's as cold as the air on the top of the mountains. Philip knows he's a ghost. So are all the other soldiers. He also knows Dr. Tyrael will only break this little girl's heart. Morton's right. She shouldn't be here, but she is.
She's been real busy, though, Phillips adds. She might be busy still.
My mom's always busy. That's her job.
Phillips laughs. That it is. Stepping into the base is like stepping into an electronic cave. She knows it's made of concrete. But she never imagined it to be as dark as it is. At the university lab, the walls are white and the floor is an endless stretch of tile. The place is cleaned every single day, and the people there wear white coats and laugh a lot. 2 breaths into her mom's forest hideout, and Janelle knows that nobody laughs here. A bowling ball solidifies in her stomach. She worries it'll be there for the rest of her visit. Janelle follows Phillips down a narrow corridor where the lights are embedded in the center of the walls, not on the ceiling. She doesn't ask why, but she counts each one she passes, and she's at 52 before they take a left turn to a spiraling concrete staircase. The only other people Janelle sees as they walk downstairs are men in military fatigues and a handful of people in scrubs. Several of the women who pass her smile, but no one says anything. Janelle gets the impression that this place must be sacrosanct. It certainly has the heavy air you find in a church or a cemetery. She wonders what sort of experiments her mother is working on here. She wonders why Morton thought it was cruel for her to see the poor fuckers. Who are they? At the bottom of the stairs, Philip swipes his badge to unlock some metal doors. They click unlocked. And he holds them open for Janelle. She steps into another corridor lined with the same lights, just like the one up above. They walk to another door. He unlocks it. But before he opens it, he looks down at Janelle,
Your mama tell you about the other children? The poor fuckers Morton was talking about? Now, come on.
Phillips fights to hold back his laughter.
They're children. But they're not children like you, understand? They've got some medical issues. They're here to see if they can make things right with them again. Because of that, they're kept separate. You know, kept in their own rooms.
My mom worked with kids at the university. Lots of sick kids. So you understand how this is going to look.
Janelle nods and acts confident, though she's not sure she actually does understand how this is going to look. The children at the university, they were in hospital beds and wore thin hospital nightgowns. Some of them had their heads shaved and needles in their arms. But they were always like Janelle, just children who didn't have the health or the mind she did. As Phillips opened the door, Janelle is worried about what she's going to see.
Are there monsters in here?
They step into a large circular room. It has high ceilings like a missile silo that Janelle read about in school once. Doctors and nurses stand around machines and desks in the center of the room. Janelle doesn't see her mother, not at first. She's too busy looking for the monsters they're hiding in this place. Janelle follows Phillips into the room, and as they walk across the concrete floor, she notices they are scuffed. Her eyes, the 50-odd doors set into the walls. They look like prison doors. Thick and steel, each is painted bright orange. There are no windows on the doors, but there are numbers stenciled in white paint. She notices 32, 33. Janelle? A young Korean man with a thin mustache and glasses walks over, hand extended. Janelle smiles shyly. She shakes his hand.
I'm Dr. Yoon Ki-sung. But you can just call me Dr. Song. I work with your mother. She's looking forward to seeing you.
Dr. Song escorts Janelle to a sub-basement via a series of winding hallways and wide concrete staircases. Her mother, Dr. Celeste Thiriot, 6 years older than the fresh-out-of-school Dr. Song, sits at a lab bench in a long, narrow room crowded with scientific equipment and silent technicians. Janelle is reminded of walking into a library. Janelle runs up to her mother and hugs her. Dr. Thiriot turns and looks down at Janelle with a cool, detached smile.
Hey there, Jenny. Good to see you.
Janelle keeps hugging her mom, so happy to be nuzzling her warmth. But she senses there's something wrong. Her mother is rigid, cold.
Honey, Dr. Thiriot says, I need you to let me go now.
Janelle pulls away, tries to hide her disappointment.
I know you're busy. The men said so.
Yes, but I'll visit with you more later. Dr. Song?
Dr. Song takes Janelle's hand and leads her back upstairs. As they walk, Janelle turns and looks back at her mother, who is bent over the microscope again. She wants her to look back, but her mother doesn't. Janelle heads upstairs, heart breaking. They pass a room with steel doors open. Inside, Janelle can see a small, frail boy strapped down on a gurney beneath a massive metal cylinder. Janelle thinks it could be a telescope, but it's squat, and the eyepiece is too big. The machine hums. The skinny boy wears a boiler suit like a prisoner, and the number 19 is stenciled on the pant legs. He shakes. Then the humming stops. Janelle stops to watch.
Is he going to be okay?
Janelle asks Dr. Song.
He'll be fine, Dr. Song says. Just running tests. Come on now.
Let me just watch for a little longer.
Dr. Song reaches for Janelle's arm, but stops himself from pulling her away. Two soldiers wheel the boy from the room. He looks drugged out, delirious. Janelle and Dr. Song walk alongside them for a moment, before the soldiers turn the cart into another room, where two women in white coats wait with several men in scrubs. One of the female doctors is Japanese. Her face is half covered by a medical mask, but her badge reads, Dr. Tomiko Kadri. The woman next to her is older, maybe in her late 30s, and her badge reads, Dr. Dorothy Sykes. The soldiers wheel the boy up in front of Dr. Sykes, and she cracks open a vial of smelling salts. The boy suddenly rouses. Dr. Song puts his hand on Janelle's shoulder. "We really should be going," he says. But there is no way Janelle is going to move. She stands firm. She needs to see what's going to happen with the boy marked 19. The boy stops trembling. Dr. Sykes asks him to tell her what he's seen. His voice sounds like a little boy's, but his words can't be his own.
"Dobre utra," he says.
Janelle has no idea what it means.
"What is your name?"
Dr. Sykes asks the boy. The boy turns to her.
"Anastasia Tchaikovsky."
Dr. Song pulls Janelle away from the door and drags her back down the hallway. Janelle tries to comprehend what she's just seen. She's frightened, her eyes darting. She wants to go home. She's desperate to see her mom again, to drag her mom from her microscope and this horrible place. 43. 10:46 a.m., November 15, 2018. University of Chicago Center for Integrative Neuroscience, Chicago, Illinois. Ashanik returned to herself. Her mother's memories faded at the back of her mind like ice melting on her tongue, lingering only for a single nostalgic moment. The monitor was blank now. The buzzing sound had ceased. Tomiko sat beside her. Leaning forward, Ashanik couldn't see Matilda. She knew Matilda wouldn't have left her alone. Something was wrong.
"What is the solution?" Tomiko asked.
Ashanik shook her head.
"I don't know what you're talking about.
Your mother hid something from us. It's a series of numbers, an answer to a complicated math problem. You know what she knew. You must see it."
"I don't see any numbers,"
Ashanik said. "But I did see you." Tomiko blanched.
"Saw me what?"
"You were there, Dr. Kadri. You were very young. I don't know why you believe so deeply in something so wrong, but you did. You're here now in this hospital doing all this research, but the place never left you, did it?"
"I need the solution, Ashanik. I'll let you go."
"No, you won't. The night doctors never let anyone go."
As Tomiko turned, reaching for her purse, Ashanik saw Matilda lying on the floor just beyond the desk. She looked as though she had fallen asleep, her body relaxed. But the way she lay sprawled out told Ashanik everything she needed to know. Matilda was hurt, and Tomiko was dangerous. Something heavy, awful, settled onto Ashanik's chest.
"If Matilda is hurt..."
Ashanik watched carefully as Tomiko reached deep into her purse, past the handle of the taser, and wrapped her fingers around the grip of a Colt Mustang handgun. Ashanik knew this was her one moment, her only chance. Wrenching her head free of the brace, Ashanik turned and kicked Tomiko out of the chair. As Tomiko struggled to get up, Ashanik leapt on the purse. Its contents spilled out across the floor, clattering against the tile. Tomiko was slow to move. When she finally rolled over, she saw Ashanik had the Colt leveled at her.
"Wake her up,"
Ashanik motioned to Matilda.
"There is smelling salts by the door," Tomiko said.
Keeping the gun on the good doctor, Ashanik backed up slowly toward the door. She locked it before she pulled the metal kit from the wall. She slid it across the tile floor to the doctor's feet.
"Wake her,"
Ashanik said.
"Now."
Tomiko opened the kit and dug around for the salts.
"She trusted you," Ashanik said. "You were her friend. I'm a colleague.
And you'd kill her just for some stupid numbers."
"Those numbers could change the course of history. They could end wars and violence and criminality. With those numbers, we could unlock all the secrets of the human mind. Imagine the things we could do."
"Wake her."
Ashanik tightened her grip on the gun. Janice had taken her shooting at least twice a month. They shot targets, bottles, pumpkins, and scrap metal. But this was different. This was a person, A real, live person. Arsenic thought her hands would be shaking. She was surprised they weren't. She was also surprised there weren't alarms going off and cops rushing into the room. The Colt was lighter than the gun she was used to firing. Almost too light. She wondered if she could truly stop Tomiko.
Okay, Tomiko said, cracking the salt. Okay.
Tomiko held the pungent white sticks under Matilda's nose. Matilda began to cough, her eyes racing behind her eyelids. Arsenic exhaled. Matilda was going to be all right.
Tell me what that place was,
Arsenic said, her voice trembling more than her hands.
What happened there?
Tomiko looked up at the Colt's barrel to the girl's eyes.
You already know this.
Arsenic said,
I see things. I don't know what they mean yet.
She pulled the trigger and the Colt bucked. The bullet sped over Tomiko's left shoulder and punched a small hole into the wall 20 feet behind her. Tomiko started talking.
Project Clarity was an experiment to alter memories, she said. Your grandmother led the project, and your mother was a subject. You have their memories inside you, carried in your genes. I know you only just went null 4 days ago. The memories are fresh. They might be overwhelming now, like a dam has burst in your head. But it'll only get worse.
Null. What does that mean?
That's what we call them, the ones in the study, who had what you're having now. The memories. It's a stupid name, really, but...
Arsenic grimaced as pain swelled in her head. She thought she heard distant voices, like the one she heard in the static of the noise-canceling headphones. They might have been panicked patients or security guards racing toward the lab. Or they were deeper voices, awakened lives.
And my mom was right? This is because of...
Tomiko stepped toward Arsenic, hands raised.
Puberty, she said. Your body is transforming. Even though you don't sense it, not explicitly, you are becoming another being. The foundational pieces of your body are changed. Along with the hormones is a cascade of neurotransmitters that wash over your brain. Glutamate receptors.
GluRs?
Yes, Tomiko smiled. You remember. Yes, that's it.
And AMPAs?
Tomiko nodded.
Aminohydroxymethylisoxazolpropionic acid receptors, AMPAs. They are chemicals crucial to memory formation. Listen, Arsenic, you have the cure. The way to stop what's happening to you hidden inside your memory. Let me get it out. Let me find the solution, and we can cure you.
You mean symbols that mean different letters and numbers?
Tomiko nodded again.
This can be all over if you just tell me what your mother knew.
Tomiko begged Arsenic, her hand shaking. Matilda sat up, eyes opened wide. She took in the scene with horror.
Arsenic, what is this?
Arsenic kept the gun leveled at Tomiko.
They're going to kill you, Dr. Kadri.
Tomiko turned to Matilda, desperate like a drowning swimmer searching for anything. Anyone to grab hold of.
Let me help.
I think you've done enough, Matilda said as she stood.
You okay?
Arsenic asked.
I'll be fine,
Matilda said.
We can't trust her.
I know.
We have to tie her up,
Arsenic said.
Use that tubing.
Arsenic kept the Colt on Tomiko. As Matilda wrapped her hand with oxygen tubing from a package on a lab bench. Then she tied Tomiko to a water pipe in the corner of the room. As she worked, Tomiko fumed.
She's not like the originals, Matilda. She isn't going to last very long. She's already got obvious synaptic degradation. Very advanced. Even if you can get a hold of Metrotime, it'll only slow the process. With the best treatment you can find out there on the run. She'll be dead within a year, but I'd give her a month.
Tomiko flashed a knowing grin. The look terrified Arsenic. She wanted to fire again, and not miss. They know for sure you exist now. They'll come after you, and they won't stop until they have you.
They see everything. They hear everything. Everyone you know, everyone you love, will be crushed. Running will only make it that much worse.
Matilda finished. The knot looked solid.
She'll scream,
Ashanik said.
Matilda grabbed medical tape from a desk drawer and wrapped it around Tomiko's head, covering her mouth in two long strips. The whole time, Tomiko stared at Ashanik like she was trying to see into the girl's very soul.
We have to go, Matilda said.
Stepping out of the room, Ashanik and Matilda found a nondescript hallway lined with doors. They moved quickly toward the end of the hall and a sharp left turn. Rounding the corner revealed an elevator bank. Men and women in scrubs and lab coats stood around, waiting for the doors to open. Ashanik tucked the Colt into the back of her pants, and she and Matilda moved quickly to join the scrum of researchers. As they stepped up to the nearest elevator, the doors to an elevator two over opened and disgorged a group of passengers. Among them was the bald man who'd come to kill Janice. The man's head gleamed in the artificial light. His hands were encased in purple latex gloves. Ashanik hid her face as the elevator doors in front of her whooshed open. She grabbed Matilda's hand and pulled her inside, squeezing past an irritated man on a cell phone. As the doors closed, Ashanik briefly glimpsed the bald man walking down the hallway toward Tomiko's lab. She knew they would only have minutes to escape the building.
44.
10:59 a.m., November 15, 2018, University of Chicago, Center for Integrative Neuroscience, Chicago, Illinois. Raid found Tomiko tied up in the lab. He looked gravely disappointed. It was as though Raid always assumed Tomiko would fuck this up, that despite her advanced degrees and cool composure, she was never really part of the team. The fact that Raid couldn't even be bothered to scream at her said it all. He locked the door behind him and squatted down beside Tomiko. Raid pushed the hair from her face and straightened the collar on her lab coat. He did it gently, but not out of any concern for her. He just hated how messy she looked in that moment.
What did she tell you?
He asked. Then, without an ounce of sympathy, he tore away the medical tape. Tomiko's lips were red and puffy, irritated by the tape.
The girl has 51's memories, Tomiko said, but she denied knowing the solution. But her readings were one of the most exaggerated I've ever seen. Even the initial imagery, only piecemeal and suggestive, was enough to trigger explosive activity in her hippocampus. She is more sensitive than any of the previous subjects. Maybe it's that I have refined equipment, or maybe it has something to do with the strength of her genes, but she's incredible. You have to understand, she's the first new generation we've seen.
And the solution?
Ashanik needs focus, a little more time, but it's in there.
But you didn't get it.
Like I said, this just happened. Only days ago, Raid, we've never had success with a null in that short of a time span. The electrical activity doubles every few days. It's only a matter of...
Where are they going?
I don't know, they didn't.
Raid dragged a straight razor from his hoodie pocket. Tomiko scrambled.
Detective.
Yes?
Matilda mentioned a detective, looking out for them. He was investigating the shooting. I think Matilda and the girl are going to try to get in touch with him. If you find the detective, you can find them. My purse, on the floor. He talked to everyone after the incident. Handed his card around.
Raid stood and walked over to Tomiko's purse. Using the straight razor, he poked through the purse's contents, as though he were an old West tracker. The kind from classic Western films, digging through the remnants of a fire pit. Looking for clues. He uncovered several business cards, but only one of them read, Chicago Homicide, Kojo's card. Raid picked it up and turned it around.
That's the one. Find him and you'll find them.
Raid walked over to Tomiko and kneeled beside her again, the straight razor hanging between his legs. Its metal tip scraped the tile floor.
Head will coordinate the search with local law enforcement,
We'll find them within hours, Raid said. The truth is, you aren't privy to the inroads they've made over the past decade. The technology has taken this whole thing much further than a few hired hands out in the field. It isn't like before. We're not detectives. But all those fresh faces they have, the ones watching the video feeds or scraping social media, even the researchers designing the next generation of tests, they don't know what we know.
Tomiko nodded, a bit too forcefully. It smacked of desperation to Raid.
They don't have the insight we have, right? Tomiko said. They haven't had the setbacks we had to work through. All those years of trial and error with the orphans. All those millions of dollars spent chasing our tails on...
I wasn't talking about research. I'm talking about the Null. You, Dr. Sykes, the rest of the team. None of you know what the Null know.
Tomiko swallowed hard.
Please, Raid, she said. I have always been loyal.
Yes, you have.
And I'm useful. I designed the protocols for the initial tests. I oversaw the data collection for the first cohorts. I was the one who recognized the first changes. It's in the notes. You can call Sykes. I can do that again. Even from here, I can help them to fix what isn't working.
What isn't working here is you.
Tomiko closed her eyes. Raid's razor flashed faster than even he could see. Merely a spark, like stone striking stone. It cut through her blouse. Blood spilled from the tear, running in rivulets onto her lab coat and pants. Raid's gloved finger explored the edge of the cut. It was very deep. He'd sunk the blade between the third and fourth ribs, slashed through the pericardium, and sliced into her heart itself. Raid knew from experience that Tomiko would bleed out within seconds, each heartbeat emptying her body. But Raid wouldn't even allow her those precious seconds.
We have seen everything,
he said, as he leaned forward, staring deep into Tomiko's quickly dilating pupils.
And we know the secret at the heart of our consciousness. You've spent your whole life looking for the answer, looking for a way to explain why humanity is so very special.
Raid caressed Tomiko's head, running his gloved hand through her hair.
I'm going to show you now.
He pulled back her hair and cut open her throat.